This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Marianne Williamson, who's running for the presidential nomination, has never held national office. She's never held any political office, but she's certainly a public figure. And like our current president, she's been a best-selling author for decades. Her books on self-help topics include A Woman's Worth and Healing the Soul of America. She's a close friend of Oprah's, and she frames her critique of Donald Trump not in political terms, not in policy terms, but in spiritual terms.
This man has reached into the psyche of the American people, and he has harnessed fear for political purposes. So, Mr. President, if you're listening, I want you to hear me, please. You have harnessed fear for political purposes, and only love can cast that out. So I, sir, I have a feeling you know what you're doing. I'm going to harness love for political purposes. I will meet you on that field, and sir, love will win.
She impressed some viewers with her convictions, however unorthodox. And after the first July debate, Marianne Williamson was the most Googled candidate. I spoke with her about her campaign for the Democratic nomination early last week. I think the fairest question to ask you is very simple. Why are you running for president?
Donald Trump being president has changed the world. And it's changed the world not only globally in terms of geopolitics, but I think personally for many people. I'm one of millions of people. I'm sure this is true of you and probably everyone listening to this program to some extent. Nothing is the same in terms of where we see ourselves in relationship to the rest of our lives, to our country, to the rest of the world. And I think that there's a deep question we're all asking, whether it's inchoate or whether very clear and conscious, which is, how can I possibly help? And I think we all feel, most of us, called on some level to use whatever skills we have to try to make a difference at a time such as this. So I challenge the idea that only the people whose careers have been entrenched for years in the limitations of the mindset that drove us into this ditch are qualified to lead us out of this ditch. I think this is one of those times in American history.
That require what? A spiritual leader above all?
Well, can we talk about the narrative of American history? Slavery did not end because the political status quo of the time decided to end slavery. It ended because with the abolitionist movement that was in fact begun by the early evangelicals and Quakers, so yes, it came from a religious and spiritual foundation, people rose up, the people stepped in. And with civil rights, the political establishment of the time did not wake up and say, let's desegregate the South. A Baptist preacher named Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, rose up. The people stepped in. So in fact, with every major course correction in terms of social justice in the United States, it has in fact been an intervention by the people themselves. And to be honest with you, David, yes, it has been centered in religious and spiritual circles.
Absolutely. William Lloyd Garrison played an enormous role. Martin Luther King played an enormous role. Are you putting yourself at that level as a spiritual and inspirational leader?
Absolutely not. I did not say that at all. I have been working for 35 years up close and personal with people whose lives are in crisis. And that's one of the things that gives me the insight I have, because I've seen what bad public policy does to people's lives. It's what gives me such a passion about changing that bad public policy. I've been working for years with people who live daily the economic tension and anxiety created by this oligarchic system. The first thing we have to do is to return to principle. This is how you change a life. This is how you change a country, because all that a country is a group of individuals. So you have to ask yourself, where am I and where am I not the person I say I am? Are the people of the United States need to emotionally and psychologically rebond with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And those principles are written on marble walls, they're written on parchment, but principles die if they're not alive in us.
I'm curious about your tactical emphasis or your genuine emphasis on harnessing emotions. Why do you see that as crucial to beating Trump?
What has happened in this country and what has happened in many places in this world is that the worst aspects of human character have been harnessed for political purposes. Racism, bigotry, anti-Semitism, homophobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, etc. No intelligent observer thought that these things didn't exist in the United States. But we thought we had reached a point, we thought we had reached a consensus several decades ago, where there were lines past which we would not go on either left or right, that no political major political entity would give a megaphone to any of these voices. Those levies have fallen. Now, the problem is not that they're more haters than decent, loving, good people. That's not the problem. The problem is that the haters in this country have become collectivized for political purposes. There are a lot of wonderful, decent, loving, really good people out there. We could harness all that and change the world.
When you become president, you enter a world of Mitch McConnell. You enter a world of a Senate that is very unlikely to be majority Democratic. You enter a world of all kinds of political realities and obstructions and difficulties. What would happen on January 20th when you become president of the United States? What would a Marianne Williamson administration look like?
There are four pillars to the moral politics that I believe that we need in this country at this point. First of all, it has to do with a moral economy. Trickle-down economics is an amoral system that has led to immoral consequences. So my sense of what needs to change economically, holding capitalism accountable, I consider myself a capitalist, but I think we need capitalism with a conscience.
And so what does that mean in terms of policy?
Well, we need to repeal the 2017 tax cut, put back in the middle class tax cut, stop the corporate subsidies. Why do we pay $26 billion in subsidies to the fossil fuel companies alone? The government needs to take back its own negotiating power with big pharmaceutical companies. We need to look how much of our military budget is actually money that the military said that they need to provide for legitimate security concerns, and how much above that is money that has to do with expenditures that mainly have to do with short-term profit maximization for defense contractors. And I agree with Elizabeth. We need that 3% tax on the assets of billionaires and 2% tax on the assets of 50 million and more. These are the kinds of changes on a pure policy level that will begin to transition us back to a functioning democracy and not just a functioning corporatocracy or oligarchy.
What would a Williamson administration look like? Who would you bring to the fore in a cabinet in your presidency?
So first of all the people in my cabinet would have to have a lot of experience in government. But they would also have the consciousness that I wish to bring. So my attorney general, for instance, would have to be someone exquisitely aware and alert to the racial disparities in our criminal sentencing, in policing, and so forth. And I would also want my attorney general to be someone who is very aware of white-collar crime and also very alert to the issues of voter suppression. So really strong, kick-ass, progressive attorney general. Yeah, kick-ass. Absolutely.
Okay, kick-ass.
Now, in terms of
Secretary of State?
Well, it's pretty funny about Secretary of State, because My idea of Secretary of State, my fantasy Secretary of State, is outside the box, but I thought, wow, this person would be perfect. And then I recently read that person say in the New York Times about my appearance, and in one of the debates, he said, that woman shouldn't even be on the stage.
Who was that?
I thought Nicholas Kristof would be the best Secretary of State, that he should be Secretary of
State. The Times columnist.
Yes, yeah. And because his geopolitical understanding of what is going on in this world is so, to me, he would be, and then what you get under him are the lieutenants, right? But then I read that he can't stand me, so I thought, well, he probably wouldn't want to work for me.
Have you met Donald Trump?
No, I saw him once. I was at Mar-a-Lago for a party when he was married to Marla Trump.
Right, Marla Maples.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Now, how long ago was that?
It was a fundraiser for an AIDS organization I had founded, so it would probably have been in the 90s.
And back then, what did you think of him?
I thought about him what I think a lot of people did. He was like this vulgar American character. I didn't hate him. I thought he was, you know, my mother would have had a word for him, a Yiddish word.
I'm not going to tell you what Yiddish word it is. We allow all Yiddish words
on this
program.
No. It's a word. But I wouldn't have, you know, at that time, and this is something that I find very mysterious, actually. If you look at interviews with him from the 80s, he was really different. He even looked different, which makes me think, gives me my own theories about what's involved in all this.
Which is?
When you see some features on someone's face change that much, I'll leave it at that. But he, even when
it's not just aging. What are we talking about?
Do your research, David. But he...
Wait. What does that mean?
I don't want to go into that. It's just that I think that there are a lot of people who find a lot very curious about the president, but I don't want to go into any of that. But I will say this, when he talked about politics.
But wait, you're running on an admirably policy of being straightforward about what you mean.
But
and
I'm
what
not
you think.
Running on a campaign of personal demonization, a personal attack. I can keep it to my conversations about the president's policies, and that's all I want to do, and that's all I would want to do if
Do you think character doesn't matter?
Character absolutely does matter, but we were getting into areas here that went beyond character. And I don't need to tell the American people the president's character, because the president's character is very obvious for all to see.
Now, I know this has come up, and I know it's controversial, and I know there have been different statements on it, so I want to get you on the record. And as a parent of someone with a severely autistic child, I want to get straight what you think about vaccinations. I'm just not quite clear on whether you're an anti-vaxxer.
I am not an
anti-vaxxer. Or you're somewhere in the middle, or you think vaccinations are right and necessary, as I do.
Vaccinations have, look at smallpox, look at polio. Where would we be without vaccinations? Vaccinations save lives. And any time that there is a medical intervention, there's benefit and there's also risk. And the government absolutely must come down on the side of the public good. I made an admittedly sloppy comment about the removal of exemptions.
Tell us what the comment was and how you would correct it.
I said that they were draconian. I said that they were Orwellian. I said, well, that sounds kind of Orwellian and draconian to me, to remove all the exemptions.
And how would you say it now?
I would not say that. It was a sloppy comment that a presidential candidate should not have said.
Fair enough. And so, in other words, what you're saying is to say, for example, the parents, the many, many parents, in fact, in the Los Angeles area who are... trying to get out of vaccines that have to do with measles, they're wrong.
The issue of a lot of those people that I've heard is I've heard legitimate questions of people wanting to know why can't the measles vaccine be a separate vaccine. I don't find people who ask those questions to be a bunch of crazy anti-vaxxers. I think that everybody is just concerned about the health of our children.
Well, that's fair enough, but sometimes even the most earnest and right-minded people are just scientifically wrong.
Indeed, and the government has to make the decision that, based on its evaluation, scientific evaluation, is in the best interest of the public, and that's what I would do as president.
You've been running for president now for a bit, and I wonder what you've learned from it. You've had some good moments, particularly in the second debate. God knows Twitter rushed in behind you, and you got an enormous
Google.
Amount of it, and Google as well.
What happened to Montana?
And then you've gotten some coverage that portray you as a kind of crystal gazing kook. You've gotten all this. How do you respond to the experience, the life experience of running for president for at least a few months?
It's certainly a
What's it like?
It's certainly a challenge to practice what you preach. I I know this sounds naive. I didn't think the left was so mean. I didn't think the left lied like this. I thought the right did that. I thought we were better.
Where have you been? And you've been getting it. What's been unfair?
Tell me. You just mentioned crystal gazing. There is no crystal in my home, David. Yeah. There's never been a crystal on stage when I've talked. I have never told an AIDS patient not to take their medicine. I've never told anyone not to take their medicine. I've never told anyone that their lovelessness created their disease. I've never told anyone they could love enough to cure their disease. I'm Jewish. I go to the doctor. This idea that I'm that person.
Let's entertain the possibility that you don't go to the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to lose well here? In other words, to have an effect while losing, and what would it be?
Of course. Well, I feel, to be honest, David, I feel I've already impacted this conversation. Were there other candidates who are talking about reparations? They wouldn't be talking about reparations if I had not opened that up and made it a pillar of my campaign.
Are you saying you introduced reparations as a campaign discussion?
I certainly did, and I hope you
wouldn't
will.
Wouldn't that come as a surprise to Cory Booker and
no,
and
it would not come as a surprise to Cory Booker. Cory would say, yep, she sure did. Absolutely. Look at my website. When, from the moment I announced in January, I talked about reparations in my opening speech. I first wrote about reparations in Healing the Soul of America, my book that came out in 1997. It has been on my website as part of my main pillar of my campaign since the very beginning in January. And I have talked about the difference between race-based policies and reparations. I have a very, very extensive conversation about that, and absolutely, yes.
Right now, as I understand it, you are not scheduled to be in the next debate.
I have the 130,000 unique donors. I got 2% at the Monmouth poll yesterday, just like Julian Castro did, Beto O'Rourke did. I, just yesterday morning, was asking myself, what's the message here? Am I supposed to just wrap it up? And I thought, well, I'll let my trip to New Hampshire tell me. And when hundreds of people are showing up, and everywhere I go, people in airports, you go, don't you leave, you stay in there.
Okay, but that happens, in fairness, that happens to any candidate who's doing the work, who's running around New Hampshire and Iowa, people come up and say,
that's
stay in
true.
There.
They don't all get what I got.
At what point do you say, in other words, what's the determinative factor?
I'll know the
you?
Point. I'll know it in my heart, but it's not yet. I'm running for president.
Marianne Williamson, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Marianne Williamson was running for the Democratic nomination. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. All over the country, young people are going back to school. College freshmen are going to orientation, and classes may have already begun. And one of the things they're learning about now is how to conduct themselves not just in class, but also in their social and intimate lives. Sexual assault on campus remains a pervasive problem. One estimate says that more than 10% of graduate and undergraduate students will be assaulted. So universities have responded with training and rules about what students should be doing and how. Alondra Nelson has seen that process up close. She's president of the Social Science Research Council, and she's also at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. A few years ago, Nelson was an advisor to a research study on student sexuality at Columbia University, and she explained that many universities are trying now to establish guidelines on what's called affirmative consent.
Often the consent has to be verbal, so someone has to say, yes, I consent to engaging and, sexual intercourse. The person has to be able to sort of freely consent, so they can't be incapacitated in any way.
So someone has to say, can I do this? And then the other person has to say, yes, I would like that.
Although in some cases one can nod or blink or moan.
Right.
Past affirmative consent can't be taken as being present or future affirmative consent. And so it has to be done in real time.
Alondra Nelson spoke at length with Joshua Rothman, who's an editor and staff writer, about this new idea of affirmative consent, how it works, how it's being taught to young people, and what it means for just about anybody who's sexually active. Here's Josh.
You know, like a lot of people, I've heard a lot about affirmative consent. And, you know, New York State and California made affirmative consent the legal standard. What does that mean for example, married people? Does the affirmative consent rule mean that they're effectively having illegal sex if they aren't asking for consent every time they have sexual contact of some kind?
Yeah, it's an open question and a good question when we think about partners, people who've been together in relationships for a long time, whether or not they should ask each other on the way out the door to work for the morning commute if it's okay to kiss.
I mean, I guess this is just a really complicated zone. And so maybe it would be helpful to just look back at where consent came from. It starts before the 1960s when the definition of what counted as rape...
An explicit violent act.
Yes, rape was defined as an explicitly violent act. And, you know, most laws held that it couldn't occur in a marriage.
Yeah, I mean, this because we're talking about a moment in which you have the emergence of things like our bodies ourselves, right? Sexual empowerment, but it's also about people's agency and control over their bodies. And so people are saying, any engagement with my body is my right to decide.
Right. Now, in the sort of Me Too era, we're sort of bumping up against the boundaries of clarity. There's new cases in which it's like increasingly unclear whether consent was given legally or not.
So what are you thinking about in particular? What kind of cases?
Well, so like in some of the Me Too cases, for example, people have allowed sexual contact, but because of power dynamics, like the perpetrator, you know, has some sort of power, like they're a boss or a studio executive, the people who gave consent or seemed to have also felt like they weren't actually capable of giving consent.
So we might think about some of the women who were harassed by Louis C.K., who didn't run out of the room, but that certainly doesn't mean that they weren't harassed. It certainly doesn't mean that they gave consent to what was happening by staying in the room.
Right. It's about the power to consent and whether people have that power. Recently, I came across a case. It just really muddied my thinking about consent. And I wonder if I could maybe tell you about it.
Sure.
So there's a woman named Michelle Lewis. She lives in New Jersey. We met at her house around her dining table. She has a puppy named Chip. And she was telling me about falling in love with a guy named Liam Allen, a British man who she met online.
You know, very charming, very polite, very gentlemanly. It was quite lovely, to be honest.
Yeah.
We're seeing each other maybe 2-3 times a week. Like, we go to the library, we'd go to the movies, we'd go to the mall, we would just people watch. The comments he would make were hysterical.
Michelle is a labor and delivery nurse, and Liam worked in healthcare IT, so they had all this work stuff to talk about. She was recently divorced. She had 2 kids. And Liam had said he was a career guy who was, you know, finally ready to get serious about starting a family. So it was a really good fit. Michelle was hopeful. They fell totally in love. And then Liam started acting like weird.
A little distant. Yeah, I could tell at this point, you know, almost 6 months into it, I could tell something was off.
Yeah.
One day he did sit me down and he's like, I got to talk to you. I was like, oh, great. The shoe's going to drop. It's going to be some horrible news that, you know, he's married or he found somebody else, you know.
So Liam tells her that although he had previously said he works in healthcare IT, he actually works for the British government. And he can't give her any more details about that unless she goes through a sort of background check.
It's basically like a life bio, like all my very personal information. It was like almost an application slash essay format.
For you to fill out.
For me to fill out.
Right.
Like my date of birth, my social security number, like the streets I grew up on and like who my closest friends were and just crazy things. I was like, I need to think about this.
This sounds really fishy.
Totally does. But Michelle's in love with Liam. She trusts him, and she sort of negotiates with Liam until it turns out she can answer the questions over the phone. So this guy named Marcus calls, and he's got a Scottish accent. He says Liam has a very demanding job. Sometimes he's going to be available, and that means he's on the map. And sometimes he's going to be unavailable, sort of on a secret mission, and that means he's off the map. And Marcus says, I'm his handler, so if you don't hear from Liam, you can call me and leave a message for him.
So this is starting to sound like a little bit of a kind of plot from, you know, 007.
I guess the way Michelle characterized it to me is like it was mysterious and sort of freaky and weird, but also like kind of exciting. And the relationship has been great so far. So, you know, it continues. Liam starts to get closer with her kids. He comes over for Thanksgiving. He meets the whole family. And shortly after that, he asks Michelle to marry him. And she says yes. But he doesn't show up for Christmas when he says he will. And the same happens at New Year's. Michelle tried calling Marcus, and he said Liam was off the map. And Michelle was just getting increasingly frustrated. Now, one of the things she'd noticed was whenever Liam left the room, he always took his wallet with him. And one day he didn't.
I don't know what made me do it. It was like some weird women's intuition, ESP. But I looked in his wallet, and the first ID I whipped out had a completely different name on it than the name I had had for over a year. Mm-hmm.
It said
William Allen Jordan.
So the truth is emerging. He's William Allen Jordan.
Right. So Michelle Googles William Allen Jordan, and she finds all this stuff about a person who has had a long history of deceiving women.
What had come up made my stomach turn. Article after article after article where he had been convicted of bigamy and fraud and was a convicted child molester on top of that. I was shaking. I had that whole tunnel vision moment where like I was sitting there and the whole world was like going away from me black.
Long story short, William Allen Jordan is arrested and charged with impersonating a government official and with fraud and with sexual assault.
I was filled with like so much like regret, like, oh my God, you know, you have that instant feeling of, you know, just dirty and disgusting and, you know, I can't believe this happened and I can't, like, I couldn't even stand myself for a little while.
She really feels that she's been sexually assaulted.
Absolutely. But the grand jury declined to press sexual assault charges against William Allen Jordan.
It was kind of ambiguous. One of the factors was that, like, mental incapacity. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it alludes to somebody who is either, like, drunk or drugged and truly cannot make a good decision, judgment at that time.
Right.
In my case, I wanted it to fit because I felt like I was robbed of my ability to make informed consent because all the information I had was completely lies.
It's really interesting that she uses that phrase.
Which phrase?
Informed consent. It's not a phrase that we typically apply to romantic relationships. It's a phrase that's used in the healthcare field. It's used in bioethics in the medical domain.
Right. So this is exactly what we were talking about before. This is why I wanted to tell you the story. I mean, we started talking about just consent, the type of consent that is better than the force requirement. And then there's affirmative consent. And then there's now even this very moving story, Michelle's story, that makes you think maybe the standard should be informed consent. Not only do you have to say yes, but you have to say yes while in possession of the truth. And it turns out that there are some states where laws against this kind of assault, which is sometimes called rape by deception or sexual assault by fraud, where that's the law. And so Michelle teamed up with a New Jersey lawmaker to try to get a similar law on the books in New Jersey.
We needed it to be specific to be able to catch the people it's intended for, but it couldn't be too broad that too many people either got erroneously accused or too many people, you know, fell through the cracks.
Michelle is putting her finger on, I think, one of the issues that we need to consider here, which is that the concept of rape by deception or sexual assault by fraud could pull a lot of people into its net. So would folks be open to charges of sexual assault if they lied about their age or if someone lied to a spouse about an extramarital affair? So I think maybe we should talk to a lawyer and find out why it's not as clear-cut as one might think.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
My name is Jeannie Sook Gerson, and I'm a professor at Harvard Law School.
And I'm Jacob Gerson. I'm also a professor at Harvard Law School.
And you guys are married?
Yes.
We are.
okay, good. Well, great. I know about Jeannie and Jacob. They're collaborators as well. They've written a paper together about changing sexual norms on campus.
Absolutely. Jeannie has also written a lot about consent and the Me Too movement for The New Yorker. They're the perfect people to talk to, really. So,
yeah.
So I told them about Michelle Lewis and about her attempt to get a law, a rape by deception law. I should say that hasn't succeeded yet, by the way. So I asked them the question you just brought up. What are some of the possible consequences of a law like this?
You can think of a lot of cases where you don't want people to go to prison for saying I'm a doctor when they're in fact a lawyer.
Or I love you.
Right. Or I love you. Or I love you.
I want to be with you.
Right. There's a sympathetic case like Michelle's case, but there are going to be some unsympathetic cases where someone's going to say, I thought I was having sex with a white person, but it turned out that they were half black and I didn't know that. They should have told me or else I would never have sex with them.
Jeannie raises something really important again. You know, time and time again, the law has been co-opted for racist ends. And so historically, claims of interracial sexual assault sometimes turned out to not be true.
Right. Like sexual assault laws are great and important, and they've also been used as tools for
racist domination.
There you go.
So what did Jeannie and Jacob have to say about how we currently think about consent?
Well, so it's complicated. And Jeannie told me that there can be a real disconnect between how the law defines consent and how people intuitively understand it.
What you might think of as a personal experience of consent might not be the same thing as what the law considers to be consent or what just another person who was there, say, thought of as consent. That word is just so overburdened with so many different kinds of definitions.
So, you know, it strikes me that this is partly what's coming up in the Me Too movement. Maybe what needs to happen is that we need to establish affirmative consent as a norm. You know, would that be helpful?
Right. So affirmative consent, like, would be helpful because, you know, it would force everyone to unite around a definition of what
consent
hopes, is.
One hopes. One hopes. Right.
But when I hear about affirmative consent rules, the more I think about putting them into practice myself, I mean, the more that they just don't sound to me terribly sexy or terribly useful. You know, so Jeannie and Jacob have studied how affirmative consent is playing out on campuses where it's taught. And they told me that it seems like even student advocates for affirmative consent don't use it all the time.
They will sometimes a little bit roll their eyes and say, well, we don't really expect every encounter to go this way. And certainly I don't practice it every single time, but it's just a good benchmark.
You know, so people say affirmative consent won't work because it's so awkward. She thinks that people don't practice perfect affirmative consent because they don't always know what they want. And, you know, not always knowing what you want is sort of built in to our sexuality. you know, we don't always know what we will or won't like.
There's a lot of sex that's about that zone of not being sure, of being experimental, you know, even doing something and having regret later. All of that is part of human sexuality, which is what has made it such a topic of such interest and fascination for millennia. I am in favor of people getting more in touch with what they want and what they don't want. But what I worry about is somehow promoting the idea that that is what sex is. It's always about what you want and what you don't want.
It's not just the law. We had a couple who were economists over, and we had a fundamental, let's say, disagreement about whether ambivalence was a real thing. And they actually just couldn't process it. What do you mean? You either want it or you don't want it. Get in touch with what you really want.
It was really striking that these economist friends, I mean, I don't mean to say all economists are like this, but these economist friends really were grappling, what do you mean somebody could want something and not want something at the same time?
And so then one comes up against the limits of the law. I mean, how can the law be asked to account for that kind of ambivalence?
So, I mean, that's exactly what I wondered.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it can, but the kind of language and protocol is that you argue one side of a case completely, and the other side argues the other side completely, and one side wins.
So let's even just take the situation of wanting it and not wanting it at the same time. Law, because it does pick a winner and a loser, it is going to have this kind of on-off effect. But you're not saying that it was all wanting or that it was all not wanting. You're never saying that. What you're saying is we've considered all of the evidence, including the wanting evidence and the not wanting, and we've made a decision about which one is going to be like predominant for this purpose, for this limited purpose.
I mean, the way she's talking, it's like the law is, it's sort of like a machine that takes, you know, an ambivalent situation and it turns out sort of a binary judgment about that situation. So, you know, that's really valuable. The question is really, when do you want to turn an ambiguous experience into a binary outcome? Like, when do you want to use the legal machinery?
Yeah. So there seems to be a still a looming question, right? So, yes, we don't want to minimize the very serious harm of rape and of sexual assault. But we also don't want to criminalize normal and healthy parts of our sexuality.
I mean, it seems like we don't have an answer to that question. You know, the laws change as culture changes. And it could be that affirmative consent will end up becoming part of that change.
I think that point's being borne out, right? And we're seeing that there are more states considering affirmative consent laws, and it's becoming a new norm.
And some people are practicing affirmative consent, you know, trying to make it more natural, like more practical.
I would love to cuddle with you. Are you interested in finding something to, some way to connect together?
Yes, I am.
This is what is known as a cuddle party.
I enjoy spooning. Would you like to spoon?
Yes. Can I be the big spoon?
Sure.
People who go to cuddle parties a lot get really good at kind of knowing what they like. Like for me, this is one I like cuddling. I like a lot of surface area, so spooning is really nice. Or being the middle spoon feels very secure.
Did you cuddle?
I did not. I asked my wife whether she would be okay with me going to the cuddle party for this radio story. And she was a little uncomfortable. And, you know, I was too. But I did talk with Madeline Guinazzo, who's a facilitator who runs the cuddle party.
So the first rule is that this is not a sexual event. The second rule is that no one has to do anything. The third rule is that you must ask first. The next rule is that if you are a yes, say yes. If you're a no, say no. The next rule is if you're a maybe, say no.
And, you know, there are lots of other rules, too. You know, there's about an hour of prep before cuddling begins. The whole event is really about negotiating what kind of cuddling can happen.
It fortifies the skills. I do think of it as like going to the gym for consent, because consent is something that takes practice. What am I really okay with? Genuinely, not because it's what's expected, not because it's what's going to get me ahead or get me the approval or get me the A or get me the job, but what do I really want?
This is fascinating. It sounds like something that comes out of a feminist utopian tradition in which people were experimenting with making new worlds, with making the worlds that they wanted to live in. It left me curious, though, Madeline's phrase, if you're a maybe, say no. Because taking it out of this bubble of the cuddle party and moving it into real life and the real world, maybe doesn't necessarily mean no. Maybe might mean not today, not right now. Try me again. Try me in a few minutes.
I mean, I don't know. Do you think we'll ever be able to change our norms such that we remove ambivalence from sexuality?
No. I mean, I think the sort of machinery of the law that you were talking about tries to flatten ambivalence, but the ambivalence remains.
All of this discussion around consent is about, you know, trying to give people power to maintain their integrity. We're trying to make rules that are going to keep us from harm. And it might just be that we can't make rules that are good enough to do that. If you want to fix sexual assault, the law only gets you so far.
Joshua Rothman is an editor and staff writer at The New Yorker, and he spoke with Alondra Nelson, who is the head of the Social Science Research Council. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On a recent Friday, The New Yorker's Carolyn Corman went to meet a 14-year-old girl named Alexandria Villaseñor, who was spending the day on a bench near the United Nations headquarters in New York.
So how many Fridays have you been out here now?
I've been on... I always forget the number. It's gotten to the point where it's like, it's either 35 or 36.
Alexandria is one of the generation of young activists inspired by Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager who addressed world leaders at the 2018 climate change conference known as COP24. Alexandria saw a video of Thunberg's speech last December, and that was it. Every Friday since, she skips school. She's on a climate strike, and she intends to keep it up until the adult world can finally get its act together and do something. Banning fossil fuels, to her mind, would be just the place to start. Here's Alexandria Villaseñor, talking with climate reporter Carolyn Corman.
I'm curious what your life was like before you started striking. What was your average day like?
Before I started my climate activism and my climate strike, a lot of my life consisted of doing theater shows because I was a theater kid, as well as just doing normal kid things, so hanging out with friends, hanging out with my family. And I used to live in California, so a lot of this was done in Northern California, and going to the rivers and the Arboretum in Davis.
Do you remember the first time you learned about climate change?
So what really got me involved in climate activism was that I moved to New York City last August. So I've been here for a full year now. But I was visiting family back in November when the Paradise Fire had broke out. So we were all in Davis. And Davis is only an hour away from Paradise, so we ended up getting a lot of the smoke. It reached 350 AQI at one point, which is air quality index, and it was also the worst air quality in the world.
At that moment?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, for example, in downtown Davis, they weren't realizing the effects of smoke inhalation, so they'd be dropping in downtown Davis. Ambulances would have to come and pick them up. But wow. For me, I noticed that my chest started to get really prickly, as it does sometimes with asthma. And it felt like needles were punching my chest. So I'd wake up nauseous every morning. I'd have to keep a wet washcloth over my face. And I got a red eye out of California at the last minute, just because all of the flights were actually booked because people were trying to leave California from the fires.
Right. And at that time, were you aware of what was happening in Paradise? Or
I started researching and Googling. Mm-hmm. I had stumbled across some articles about climate change, talking about what it's doing to California and the wildfires. I had come across COP24, and I'd hoped that world leaders would come to a sufficient agreement to stay in line with the IPCC report that came out last October and reduce their global greenhouse gas emissions. And when they didn't, I remember being really upset. And I had seen Greta Thunberg speak, and she had really empowered me to start my strike on the last day of COP24, which was December 14th.
And Greta Thunberg is your good friend, the climate activist, Swedish climate activist. And how much time would you say that you spend talking to other climate activists around the world, your peers, via Twitter or whatever messaging platform you use?
Let's see, there's 24 hours in a day, and I have to spend at least 6 hours sleeping.
Just 6 hours?
Well, I fell asleep at like 1 a.m. last night because I had to do some emails and some phone calls that happen at like 8. And so, yes, about 6 hours, but it's okay because it changes. But I usually spend about 15 hours a day talking to other youth climate activists.
What apps do you use?
All forms of social media, so Twitter, Instagram, but then we also go to WhatsApp. We use Slack, we use Discord. Discord is actually an international gamers chat, but we use it a lot for international communication.
For chatting? There's nothing to do with gaming.
Nothing to do with gaming.
Okay. So, in I think it was in March, you were quoted in a piece on Breitbart.
You checked out the article. Oh, that's great.
And what was the response to that piece like?
It was interesting. So I have thick skin when it comes to any trolls or climate deniers. But a lot of the times for people in my family and my parents, it's scary. And so just seeing the comments on Breitbart, so after Breitbart put up the article, the comments got so many death threats that Breitbart had to disable the comments, purge the comments, then they put them right back up. And so after the Breitbart article came out and the death threats got very scary, then I usually have a family member out with me at the strike every Friday.
I find writing about climate change and being immersed in this stuff all the time, it can be quite draining and sometimes depressing and scary and cause a lot of anxiety. So I wonder, do you feel similarly, or how do you take a break from how depressing it can be?
The climate crisis causes a lot of anxiety and eco grief.
That's a new term for me.
I'm not sure if I just made it up. I feel like I've heard it before, but I could have just made it up. But how I combat that is taking action. When I go out and protest, when I take direct actions, and when I strike, it's one of the ways that I feel empowered about my future, that I have a say in what's going to happen.
And I guess, yeah, since you've been coming out here conducting these school strikes, has your outlook on the world changed?
I think the way that my view on life has changed since I started organizing is I see more of the structures that society has put in place. And that's one of the things that my generation, why we're so impactful with the climate movement, is because of how we're organizing outside of this structure that adults work in. And we see outside of the system. We just think about what we need to do. We don't think about what's politically possible. We just think about what needs to happen.
Alexandra Villaseñor, climate striking on a recent Friday afternoon. She's helping to organize the global climate strike slated for September 20th. And she spoke with The New Yorker's Carolyn Corman. Now we've got time for one more thing today, a story. Elizabeth Strout's book, Olive Kittredge, came out more than a decade ago. Her main character, Olive, was not at all easy to love. She was hard, cold, bitter about something that we couldn't quite make out. Olive often seemed needlessly cruel, even to the people she loved. But somehow she felt real to readers and critics alike. And Strout won the Pulitzer Prize for Olive Kittredge. At NewYorker.com, you can find Strout reading a new story about Olive called Motherless Child. It's set about 3 years after the end of the previous book, and it's about the relationship between Olive and her adult son, Chris. He's brought his family to come visit her in Maine.
After Anne had taken the older children into the study, where the couch had been turned into a bed, Olive sat with Christopher and little Henry, who dangled from his father's lap. "Cute kid," Olive said, and Christopher said, "He really is, right?" From the study, she could hear Anne murmuring and the higher-pitched voices, but not the words of the children. Olive stood up and said, "Oh, Christopher, I knit little Henry a scarf." She went into the study, the two older kids just stood silently and watched her, and got the scarf she had knitted, bright red, and brought it out, and she gave it to Christopher, who said, "Hey, Henry, look at what your grandmother made for you." And the little boy put part of it into his mouth. "Silly thing," Christopher said to him and pulled it gently. "You wear it to keep warm." And the child clapped his hands. Olive thought he was really a fairly amazing child. Anne appeared in the doorway, flanked by the older kids, who were now in their pajamas. She said, Olive?" She pursed her lips a moment and then said, "Do you have anything for the other children?" Olive felt a darkness rising swiftly through her. It took her a moment to trust herself. Then she said, "I don't know what you mean, Anne. Are you talking about Christmas presents? I sent the children Christmas presents." "Yeah," Anne said slowly, "but that was, you know, Christmas." Olive said, "Well, I never heard a word from you, so perhaps they didn't get them." "No, we got them," Anne said. Then she said to Theodore, "Remember that truck?" The child shrugged one shoulder and turned away. And yet they stood there, that beastly mother and her two children from two different men, stood right there in the doorway as though Olive were supposed to produce. What was she supposed to produce?
Elizabeth Strout reading from Motherless Child, an excerpt from her book, Olive Again, a sequel of sorts, which comes out this fall. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.